I will say 99% of you are training putting wrong. I hate to say it, putting has gotten better, but we're still pretty archaic. So why did golf cast come about? Really was, I kind of found, I'm getting older. So I'm like, I can stay in the rat race and keep doing what I've been doing, and I love it. But I was like, you know, it's time to start slowing down, starting to build more community base. And there's nothing better than sitting down after a good round of golf by the fire pit with a good cigar, a whiskey, the boys you played with, and just rehashing what just happened. I always say ball striking is important. Putting, we show up kind of, we take the glory at the end.
There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out, is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rippin', rippin'.
All right, Brian, I'm going to butcher your last name. I know, I think I could spell it. Is it Bailey? Bailey?
It's actually Bailey, yeah.
Bailey, okay, so I got kind of crushed. But it's not spelled, yeah, I was going to say it's not spelled the same way that we spell it here.
No problem.
Brian Bailey joining us from Virginia. Are you the founder and owner of GolfCast? Was this all your idea?
This was, yeah, mostly. A few years back, I was coaching in Ireland, and I was sitting down with a couple buddies I was coaching with, and we're literally in a pub drinking whiskey, looking around, and I'm like, why in the hell are we not taking people with us? Like, we are literally at one of the nicest places on earth, enjoying ourselves, just having a grand time, and that was kind of the evolution of golf, whiskey, and I guess cigars have kind of slid into it, which is golfcast.com. So yeah, we built a website, or basically I've built a website designed on those three passions. So if you enjoy golf, whiskey, cigars, don't care your ratio. If you're 100% golf, come on in. We have golf content. If you're 100% cigars, we have cigar content. Or if you're like most of us that are on the golf course that are playing on for weekend fun and you're a variation of, we got you covered.
Yeah, I'm like, I'll give you my breakdown. I'm probably 80, 15, 5. I've actually taken a little bit more of a liking to cigars in the last year because I don't like drink as much. For me, like on the course drinking, I find if I have one too many, like I'm not one of those guys where it actually helps. I've got a lot
performance
of
trends are bad.
Yeah, man. Like I got a lot of buddies where like when they find that perfect mix of like a couple drinks, maybe a cigarette or two, all of a sudden they go from like a 6 handicap down to a 2 or a 1. I am the complete opposite. So I can kind of
weigh the averages. You weigh the averages. Yeah. That's perfect.
Yeah, exactly. So you're before all this started, you are a golf coach by trade. Is that correct?
Correct. I've been coaching golf for about 30 years now. God, I'm old.
Oh, wow.
20 years collegiately. I coached at the Division III level, the Division II level, and then the last 11 years at the Division I level at the University of Virginia on the women's side. And that's kind of where I was a good swing coach. The new head coach that came into Virginia was a better swing coach. So I learned a lot there, but the one gap we had was we were terrible at putting. So I said, hey, I can bring value to the team. I'm going to go solve this putting thing. Well, it's been 30 years now, and I haven't solved it. I've gotten better, but I went down the rabbit hole of putting and short game, and so for the last 15, 18 years, that's pretty much all I do now is putting and short game.
Well, it's actually funny you mentioned this, so I am a little bit curious. Like, golf has changed so much, especially now. Like, when I was actually in the sauna yesterday, just randomly talking to a guy, and we were talking about how he played golf in high school and how much the game has changed now. And one of the things that we started talking about was like all the different types of coaches. He's like, dude, back when I played, like we had one golf coach and that was it. Like they taught you everything, you know, they did all of it. And now, you know, you got like mental coaches and you got full swing. Maybe like guys and gals got a full swing. They've got a short game coach. They've got a putting coach and they've maybe got like somebody mental involved. If you've been doing this for 30 years, like, when did you see that start to change and become a lot more common where now a lot of these organizations will have 2, 3, 4 coaches on staff?
I think really what was kind of the revolution of the ball flight laws. Once those became kind of self-evident, which they were self-evident, but they were not taught. So once that really got absorbed, your ability as a coach to be a really good swing coach and to be a really good short game coach and to be a really good putting coach no longer existed, because there was just too much information and too much that you really had to dive into to truly understand and how to get your players better. So I think the revolution in technology kind of separated everything. I view it almost as the medical field, right? You have a general doctor, but once the general doctor gets you to a certain point, you need specialists to come in to fix certain issues. I think golf is kind of, in sports in general, now with data science, you know, you have a data guy, you have a strength and conditioning, you have a nutritionist, you have a sports psychologist. We haven't even gotten on the golf course yet. Now we got a, you know, a swing coach, we got a putting coach, we got a short game coach, we might have a,
you know, equipment guy. Like, I know a lot of people have like their equipment people too.
Yeah, you have equipment people, you have a course management guy that might come walk out and really go through the scenario. Like, there's so much to it because, again, I always say golf is the hardest sport to play on earth. And the reason why is it makes the decathlon look easy, right? The decathlon, you have to be good at 10 events, which usually a good decathlete is going to be good at 3 or 4 and just kind of try to survive the other. If you can't drive the ball, you can't play this game. If you cannot putt, you cannot play this game. If you cannot hit short game shots, you cannot play this game. If you can't hit good irons, you cannot play this. So there's so many pieces inside of golf that have to move to allow you to perform well. I think is kind of that structure has really created these kind of side pockets. And as a putting coach, I always laugh. We're the worst. It's the worst profession on earth. I always say with a putting coach, you don't need us until you start shooting 70s. And really that math came, I had a data science company. I was a founder of a data science company that I just walked away from. About a year and a half ago, but the data really showed if you're a 100 shooter, you average about 38 putts around. The average tour player is going to shoot about 29 putts per round. It's like 7 strokes. They're better than you by 7 strokes on the putting green. Ball striking, they're going to do it in about 40, 41 shots. You're going to do it at about 62. So they're 22 shots better than you getting to the green and very small advantage of you when you're on the green. So for all you beginners out there and hundreds and 90s and 80 shooters, ball striking is the most important piece on earth. That ability to control that variance and be able to control your golf ball and hit it long enough to play. So, you know, it's about a 5-to-1 ratio, right? So as you're kind of improving from 100 to 95, you're going to pick up about a half a putting stroke, but you're going to pick up about 2.5-3 shots in the fairway. Oops. And as you keep moving forward, so again, there's big gains in ball striking. But for me, the lonely putting coach, I'm just sitting there going, you don't really need me because I can make you a great putter. But if you only have one putt inside of 20 feet all day, you're not a great putter because you just don't have the opportunity. So yeah. I always say ball striking is important. Putting, we show up kind of, we take the glory at the end.
Well, it's funny too, because like a lot of people will consider and say that putting is almost its own game. You know, like the game of golf, like, you know, there's, like you said, kind of ball striking, mental, all that stuff. And then, like, you get on the green, and now you're, like, playing this whole new game. Like, the putting yep. stroke is nowhere near the same of, like, what a chip or a iron swing or a driver is, right? And, like, you're doing something completely different in terms of, like, reading a green. And, again, like, when you start to, like, when you think about, like, the one thing that anybody can do at home or pretty much anybody has ever done, it's putt, right? Like, people will go to, you know, putt courses, and like I could go give my now wife, I could go give her a putter, and like she's at least going to be able to kind of like hit the ball around and know what she's doing. Dude, if I give her, this is a true story. She was like trying to get into golf and like play golf a little bit a couple of years ago, and like we got her just a set from the local store, and I'm not joking, man. Like 5 holes in, she just snaps her driver because like she doesn't know how to swing it. She's like trying to take a slap shot like she played hockey, and just like right into the ground, and the head snaps off. And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe golf's not for you, but like we can get you on the green and you'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll go putt.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. Like putting is a different game, and it's different. It is a swing. So I get in arguments with people all the time. There is a swing component to the putting stroke. It's not a swing, but it moves in a completely different time ratio than kind of your full swing. So it is different. I would say it's a cousin to your full swing. There are some similarities, but there are also some big gap differences between the two. And again, I think in the revolution of golf, I think it's been brilliant. Like the, you know, once TrackMan, you know, all Foresight, all these guys came along, like revolutionized coaching and the fact that you were able to see things that you couldn't see with your eye. So it, as a coach, it gave you tools to get players to do things differently and give you that instant feedback of what we're trying to do working. I hate to say it, putting has gotten better, but we're still pretty archaic. A lot of the beliefs inside of the putting world are still, you can only read greens if you, you know, if you, you're blessed with the ability to read greens. Yeah, that's not true. You know, you can only be a good putter if, nah, you can train to be a good putter. But again, most people don't put the hours and the time and see the right people to get better inside of putting. They think equipment change or a YouTube video or something like that is going to completely change their game. Putting is hard. It's simple in theory and practicality, but again, it is a hard motion in the fact that it is a lot of coordinated pieces that have to go for you to be really good at putting. And I say most people probably train putting wrong. I will say 99% of you are training putting wrong. And that's a big number. I just want to throw that out as a hot take so people will listen.
Well, we'll break it down real quick. I don't want to derail us too much. But like, so for your collegiate players that you've coached, you know, if they have 100 hours, right?
Yep.
For everything golf, what do you think the breakdown is for putting specifically? And maybe we'll just even take away like the mental and the strategy and all that. Let's just talk about like practice, right? So like most people, I'd say most amateurs, the way they structure practice is like driving range. If they're lucky, they're able to hit like the short game range and then they hit some putts, right? Like most people, that's kind of how they structure it. What are you seeing your collegiate players? How much of that time are they dedicating solely to putting?
We ran a basic ratio. It was 3-2-1. 3x on the driving range, 2x on the putting green, 1x on the short game. So that was kind of your progression. Now, if a player had a gap, we would alter that gap. So if they missed a lot of greens, we'd spend more time ball striking and more time short game and maybe pull away on putting and put more emphasis on short putts because they're chipping more. Like, so you would kind of alter that. But, you know, if you kind of break down golf in general, that is about what it is. It's about depending, you know, if you're an 80 shooter, you're going to hit 3X, 2X, 1X is kind of the way that you play. So training should kind of mirror play, you know, ideally, you know, if I roughly. So to me, anytime that you're on the putting green, if I'm going to spend an hour on the range, I'm going to spend probably 30, 40 minutes on the putting green, maybe 15, 20 minutes short game. Yeah, and again, like I said, be able to kind of flex that where you need. But again, I would say more important than that time is how am I going to organize and structure that training? This is where, again, I think a lot of people go wrong. A lot of people sit there and hit a bunch of 3-foot putts. I got to make 30 in a row. Okay, what does that train? Well, maybe it gives you some confidence. But, you know, if you think about how the brain works, after the about putt 3, it's solved the riddle. We know the start line. We know the speed. We know all these components. Your brain just goes to bed. And then about putt 27, it perks back up because it knows if I miss one of these last three,
yeah,
you know, there's consequences. But we just spent a 10-minute gap in between there where the brain didn't. It was just mindless training. So I think that the training component and understanding what you're trying to accomplish in a day and creating that structure is much more important than the block of time. But inside of that block of time, you've got to say, hey, there's technique pieces, there's some skill pieces, there's some performance pieces that I have to hit to make today a successful training day. And I don't think that's done. Most people short game and putting, well, most people just bypass a short game field. Like they just go right past those. They don't even look at that. And then they go to the putting green. They, you know, they hit a couple 3-footers, roll a couple long ones, and they're like, I'm ready. Yeah. All right, let's go.
Yeah. Well, which might be fine for, you know, casual, but it's like if you're actually trying to practice and get something out of it, I found like my favorite quote unquote 3-foot putting drills. I do the, like 6 balls around the circle, you know, like I literally lay my putter down in the hole this is about, I think I have like a, well, I've got a little longer putter. I've got a broomstick, which we'll get to in a second.
There you go.
You know, it's like 38 inches or something, I guess. Yeah. Short. It's about 3 feet. I lay it down and I kind of like move it around in a circle around the hole. Then I put balls in like six locations. So then all my 3 feet putts are different, right? Like unless you're on a perfect putting surface, like, so we're going to break left to right. So we're going to break right to left. So we're going to be that straight uphill, downhill. And that's how I found that I started to actually improve my 3 foot putting. To your point, like if you just find a dead straight one, all you're practicing is like set up and making sure you're in the right spot every time. But you're not actually practicing like a 3 foot putt correctly.
No, I call it exercise. At that point, I say you're just doing exercise. You are not sitting down at your couch and watching TV, which is good, but you are literally doing exercise right now. You're not learning anything. And I would say take your drill and move it to 4 feet, because at 4 feet, break really starts to show up well. So you could take your drill, just add 6 inches really, and then, you know, at a 3% putt, you're looking at, you know, 6 inches of break, or not 6 inches, about 4 inches break, give or take. So that it's going to start to add break value as well. Be a really good way for you to start to understand break components. So 3 feet, you can start to manipulate a little bit with power and speed, and a lot of putts get inside the hole. At 4 feet, pretty much 1% is inside the hole. Everything is outside the hole. So it's a good way to start learning break as well.
Yeah.
A little putt enhancement.
Yeah, yeah. My last question, my listeners would kill me if I didn't ask this. How much have you seen the zero torque trend come into play with a lot of your players that you coach or walk through putters in the last couple year or two?
They've all tried it. Whether they have
how many stick with it? And do you you know, I've had a couple people on to talk about zero torque. I'm going to have a guy from Lab Golf come on. You know, my take is at the end of the day, like putting is one of those things, like you got to be confident over it. It's got to fit to your stroke. I think like the zero torque really adheres to what I would consider, like, I don't want to say bad putters, but just, you know, people that maybe don't know all the differences and like, you know, lie angle and toe hang and all those things. It makes it very simple with the straight forward, straight back. So I think the masses really like that. But I do just kind of want your take on it, because it's like this has been the phenomenon in golf for the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's good for some. To me, it's a band-aid. It depends on the putter. If a putter needs closure for what, like Tiger Woods at his best used it, aimed a little right and kind of slammed his face shut, and he was a really good putter that way. Awesome. He would have been really, really bad with a live putter, because that putter would have been fighting him. So again, to me, it's a tool in the arsenal. Does it fix everything? God, no. There's nothing in golf that is fixed by one component. You can learn greed reading, and it's not going to it'll change your putting, but it won't fix it. You can change your equipment. Could make it better, but we still haven't fixed the underlying conditions inside of my putting stroke. So to me, to steal verbiage from David Orr, who's a putting coach that I've worked a lot under for the years, is it's grandpa's gun, right? It works for me, but it's not going to work for you. You know, that's kind of putting in general. So that concept of, here, do this, this is going to solve it. For some, it helps. For many, it's neutral. And for some, it will actually be a negative component inside of their putting stroke. So just like all great manufacturer advances, help some, hurt some, most won't really notice.
Yeah, 100%. All right, I've asked all my putting questions up to this point. I had no idea you were going to go so deep. So now I got to ask. So coaching is kind of the I'll call it full time job, or what you've been doing forever.
Yeah.
So like before you actually started Golf Cask, was like, did you have this passion for playing overseas and you know, playing in Ireland and Scotland, or like, you know, there seems to be this very direct correlation between, you know, call it like the whiskey guys in golf and like, you know, doing stuff overseas. I mean, I just went on a trip to Ireland. Gosh, what is that, 2 summers ago now? And I'll tell you, like the way that they do golf over there is almost more social, and it's about the stuff that you do afterwards than it is the stuff that you do on course. And I feel like in America, it's very the inverse. It's all about the stuff you like do on course, then the afterwards is almost starting to lose a little bit of its, you know, like people are like, no, I got to go do this. I got to go do that.
Yep.
We're overseas.
I'm so busy.
Yeah, I'm so busy overseas. And I don't know, just because we were on a trip, but just in general, I felt like everybody was like, they just wanted to get inside and drink. And so I want to hear a little bit about, you know, kind of your passion, how you found all this.
God bless the Irish. No, well, you got to remember, it's the home of whiskey, the home of golf is Scotland and Ireland. So, you know, the beauty of whiskey and golf together is they run very similar tracks. Yeah, it's a very Western, you know, kind of lifestyle piece. Golf is very Western. If you look at golf courses around the world, the United States and Europe is predominantly it. You know, yeah, Australia's got some, Asia has some. But if you want to play golf, there's really, you're either in the West, you know, kind of in the Western hemisphere lifestyle. Whiskey is kind of the same. You know, it's Scotland, it's Ireland, it's Canada, it's U.S. Those are four of the five big mass producers of whiskey. So the parallels are really funny. And that's where, you know, as I started getting more and more into whiskey, I started to, you know, I already knew the golf history. And I'm like, oh, my God, like all these components are kind of moving together. But to go back to your question, in Ireland, on the golf course, they're ultra serious. In America, you know, you got tunes, you got drinking, you got cigars, you got fun. They don't do that in Ireland. They're just like, but when they leave the golf course, they take what we do on the golf course and take it to the pub. And then we as Americans are like, oh, I'm really busy. I got this to do, that to do. I can't have a beer with you, or, you know, can't have a pour with you and leave. So the cultures are really funny. So my friends from Ireland, when they come over and play golf, they love the fact that we got the cart going with music and, you know, banter and just having a fun round of golf, because that is not done. You know, in Ireland, they're playing four ball, they're playing two ball, they're playing foursome, they're playing matches week in, week out on the weekends. They take all those components very, very serious. And they come here and they're like, what is it? They're like, a breakfast ball? What is that? Like,
two out, no, I've never heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, they're just like, what is this? And it's just like, so on those components, it's really funny. But, you know, but the one thing I do appreciate, each culture, if you do play golf, it's going to take you, depending on where you play, 4 to 6 hours. Hopefully not six, closer to four.
Yeah. But hopefully a lot, you know, closer to four. Yeah.
You know, I like the 3 to 3.5 round. Chef kiss, that's perfect for me. But, you know, you tend to get, you know, widespread. But, you know, so to me, the beauty of a golf is it's a slow process and you're with people for hours. Ideally, a good whiskey, a good cigar, you know, a cigar is going to take you 45 minutes to an hour to smoke if it's done properly. A good pour whiskey should take you 30 minutes to go through. We're not shooting it like shots. You know, inside of whiskey, we're sitting back and enjoying the flavors. So kind of the concept was, is these are my three main passions and they all take time. They force you to slow down and carve out time for that kind of community, kind of personal note, you know, spending time with people opposed to that rushed lifestyle that we're all in. We have a whiskey group that meets once a month where we do blind tastings. We have a burlap bag. I don't have it near me. And we slide our phones in it and we zip it and we put it away. So for the next hour, it's just us. There's no scrolling. There's no look at my favorite meme. It's just an hour of conversation, enjoying the whiskey, enjoying the camaraderie. And so, you know, going back to why did GolfCast come about, it really was, I kind of find, you know, I'm getting older. I don't know how many more trips around the sun I'm going to make. So I'm like, I can keep stay in the rat race and keep doing what I've been doing. And I love it. But I was like, you know, it's time to start slowing down, starting to build more community base than that actual, the craziness of now. Granted, my kids are older. My son is 18. He's getting ready to go play Division II college golf. Like my life is getting disproportionately easier every year because there's less and less commitment and things that I have to do. But, you know, kind of the big thing was, and there's nothing better than sitting down after a good round of golf by the fire pit with a good cigar, a whiskey, the boys you played with, and just rehashing what just happened. And you know, especially if it's a bunch of males around, it's going to be brutal. It's going to be funny.
Yeah.
And it's to me, those are the fun parts where, you know, that is what we're trying to build inside a golf cask. And again, like I said, I'm a data science guy, so there's going to be a lot of data science stuff built in the back end that people won't see yet, but it's a fun activity. So if you do enjoy whiskey and golf, cigars, come check us out. It's free.
Yeah, you're gonna get some hits for sure. I think there's probably a few people listening that are gonna like this. I admittedly am not a massive whiskey guy. For me, I'm more of a tequila guy, but not in the sense of like a. So the tequila I drink, I don't know how familiar you are with tequila, but
I'd love say tequila like
five.
Too.
Yeah, so 5 years ago, I was actually coincidentally sitting in a cigar lounge, and. Buddy poured me this glass, and it looked like whiskey. I mean, it was like dark. It's a extra añejo. It's called a Cava de Oro. If you haven't heard of it, you should go get a bottle. Everybody that drinks it immediately becomes their favorite. It's almost got this like syrupy taste, and people for whatever reason tend to think that it's whiskey. So it's phenomenal. My where I'm going with this is ever since I found that, it's been like the only thing that I drink. We just had it at our wedding, passed out shots of it. People are like, what is this stuff? It tastes like maple syrup. Is this whiskey? Is it tequila? What is it? But it's like my pride and joy being able to introduce people to it that have like never heard of it, right? And so like for you, for whiskey, I got to imagine maybe you found one or two that people have never heard of, and it's like your favorite. I mean, everybody's heard of the... You know, for me, it's like Buffalo Trace and Maker's Mark. I actually saw your article that like you took the last sip of Buffalo Trace you ever will in your life. We'll get to that.
No, I didn't say it exactly.
Yeah, it was something like that. It was something like that. But I want to know, like, what's maybe one of the best whiskeys out there that's really slept on that people don't know about that either is your favorite or a lot of people that you've introduced it to becomes their favorite?
Yeah, the whiskey market, there is so much of it. The big brands are great. So, caveat, Buffalo Trace. We did a blind tasting a few weeks ago, and somebody actually brought Buffalo Trace as their blind tasting. And we all took a sip of it. It was very bland, very muted. I got the caramel. It was very, compared to what we drank that night, it just got demolished. It's a good pour. It's a good whiskey. People love it. It's 20 some bucks. It's a great deal. Like, it's a good whiskey. But that night, it got destroyed by two craft guys. So two guys, you know, smaller distillers, and then an Irish whiskey just destroyed it. So it was just funny that night. Like, I like Buffalo. I got probably four bottles over there. I like Buffalo Trace, but that night it was just like, didn't hold
it in. Maybe it was a bad batch or barrel or
just, it could have been a bad batch.
Really good, then it just could have been that.
It could have been me that night. I ate something that kind of shut down some of my receptors and I couldn't pick out components, but it was very watered down. But it was also being compared to everything we drank that night, and it just got shellacked. But I would say if you're coming into the whiskey world, Buffalo Trace is good. Wild Turkey 101. Evan Williams Bottle and Bonded would probably be your three low entry whiskeys. They're going to give you caramel, they're going to give you vanilla, they're going to give you all of those components when you think of an American bourbon. That's it. So I would say those would be your good entry whiskeys. I would say if you wanted to start to spend a little bit more money, now you're looking in that $30 to $50 range. Redwood Empire is one of my favorites. They're based out of, I think, Oregon. Really good, a little bit of different flavor. Really good mid-level whiskey. Oh God, I literally have 200 bottles on my wall. It circles my entire basement. I'm really into the Leopold Brothers right now. They're Bottle and Bonded. It's absolutely spectacular. You get mint and herb in it, which is not a traditional flavor that you get inside of a bourbon. But because of their rye component, it actually brings some of that in. And then you can go higher level. You know, to me, Wild Turkey Rare Breed is probably in the winter is my go-to. Higher proof, but gives you every bourbon component you want. Lots of sugar, sweet caramel, tons of spice. It's perfect in a bottle, really easy to find. But that would be a higher level. You know, you're looking at probably about 120 proof, so you're getting up there in proof. It's a really, really...
You only need one of those, yeah, for your...
That's the beauty of... But again, a good whiskey drinker is going to have a pour, and that's your night. It's a drink. You know, when I was younger, my intention, and we talk about this all the time in golf, what is your intention right now? Well, when I was younger, whiskey and intention was completely different than what the way I drink whiskey now. Yeah, let's put it that way. The results and everything were completely different than what I'm trying to achieve today. So what I've learned is I've learned to enjoy finding the tasting notes, you know, enjoying what were they trying to create here, that component more so than, you know, how many of these can I put down in the next 20 minutes before we go out tonight. Like that's not the component. Yeah. I'm trying to save money tonight, so I'm going to drink three of these real quick and then we'll hit the town. So,
yeah.
But you know, so again, the similarities of, you know, I think golf is the same way. I love playing golf. I love playing my home track, but there's nothing better than going to a golf course you've never been to and saying, all right, let's see how my skill set stacks up to this, you know? And I think the whiskey's the same way. I have my daily pours that I like, but to me, there's nothing better than sitting down with a whiskey I've never had and saying, man, I'm excited about what this is getting ready to bring me. Cause I don't know, like I don't read up on it. You know, I've gotten to the point now where whiskey companies are sending me bottles. I don't even read
their... that's a great place to be at, Brian. I'll tell you
Is
that.
There anything better than in the mail? Yeah. Two bottles. Let's see. These two just showed up 2 days ago.
Oh, that's a sweet logo.
Yeah, they're
a little different.
They're craft whiskey makers in L.A. and they're screenwriters. So they say their bottles are adult cereal boxes.
Yeah, whiskey's it kind of looks like it. Yeah, yeah.
So their whole thing. So I have my whiskey group. So we call it an emergency meeting. So Friday night we have an emergency meeting. We're going to taste these and give them our feedback. So I have the luxury of, and then I'm trying to get cigar companies to do the same. So then they're going to basically fuel my passions, which is a pleasure all in itself.
Man, I have this combo all the time because people are like, you know, why don't you go full time with, you know, the podcast, like do that. It looks like it's doing so well. I'm like, man, I love it and it's a passion. And one of the perks is like, sometimes I get free equipment. Like I've gotten free putters before. I've gotten like free clothes. And I just like,
you open it up, you're like,
Yeah, and it's just like it's more fun when like you truly love it and you enjoy it, and I think that's what makes it so awesome. It sounds like you've kind of got the same thing. Now you're getting whiskey bottles, and maybe you'll get some cigars. And I have to ask, like I don't know if this is going to be accurate or not, but you know, the way I think of cigars is like you have your, you know, more like dark cigars, more like stronger, than you have kind of like the mild in the middle, and then you've got your light, right?
Yeah.
Is there like a equation of like the type of cigar? Like, let's say somebody out there is listening, they're like, yeah, I like the lighter cigars. You know, I don't like them like super strong or dark. Like, what type of whiskey should they be pairing that with? Like, is there a similar ratio along those lines or not really?
I would say I pair in two separate ways. I pair in similarity and in contrast. So we have if you go read any of our like whiskey write-ups where we do pairings, it'll say kind of here's the, kind of the equal. So if you like Buffalo Trace, you like the sweet, the caramel, a little bit of spice, maybe a Connecticut mild, you know, something make like a Nub 466 Connecticut, something that's going to be mild. It's going to give you a lot of those sweet tones just kind of as a Buffalo Trace would. Or... Like in golf, I like to do with my players, let's go 180. Let's do something completely different. So maybe instead of, you know, highlighting the sweet notes from the cigar, maybe we go with a peated scotch. It's got this earthy bite to it. And what does that do to the cigar? Sometimes it works. Sometimes it's a train wreck.
But sometimes you need to do something.
But the fun is trying. Like, you know, so my whiskey group, about once every other month, somebody will provide a cigar, and we'll research a cigar, and then the rest of us bring a bottle of whiskey, and we try to think what's going to pair best. And you can either pair to similarities or to contrast, and we sit down, and we smoke the cigar, we sample all the different whiskeys, and we say who won. Because again, like in golf, everything's a competition that we do. Like literally everything's a competition. So like who brought the best whiskey tonight? And we vote on it, and you know, nobody wins anything other than pride. But I think the component, again, and it's just like golf, like I said, it's there's times to match similarities, but there's sometimes it's just like, screw it, man. Let's do different. okay, you would hit the safe shot here out into the fairway, but you know, sometimes it's screw it. Can we work it through that gap and turn it? Let's try it. You know, it's practice.
Yeah.
It's safe. But so I would say a lot of times, so again, you can think of whiskeys the same way. You have mild flavors, you have bold flavors, then you have over the top. And I would say cigars are the same way. To me, majority of cigars are going to give you bitters. So bourbons do really well because they are sweet. So you tend to get a lot of, you know, you tend to get a little symbiotic that way. But there are cigars that are sweet and there are whiskeys that are bitter. So it's you know, so the beauty, again, what I've learned inside of whiskey is everybody has a flavor profile. Everybody likes what they like. So even though I say these two pair perfectly together, you know, I get people that will write me and go, you're a moron. Number one, yes.
Maybe.
Number two.
Yeah, could be.
Number two, okay. I'm just telling you what I like and how it paired for me. Whether you like it that way, I don't know. But it's fun. And like I said, they just work together. Like I said, everything's about just slowing down, getting in the moment and enjoying what you're doing today. You know, getting the phone put away, those components, and like I said, golf, whiskey, and cigars, all three. You know, some nights I just go sit on the deck, fire pit going, and I just have a cigar. Or some nights I have the fire pit going, I just have a whiskey. Some nights I sit there and I'm reading a golf book. You know, so, you know, but again, we as humans need social interaction. That's massive. And we need time to enjoy something other than doom scrolling and, you know, watching television. You need that component to better your life, you know, to have a passion and something you pour into. So that's kind of in GolfCast, we're trying to give you that.
Yeah. No, I don't think you're going to find many people that disagree with you on many of those points. As we wrap up, I need to know two things. One, I need to know your favorite bottle. What's the go-to? And then two, I'm just curious now that clearly you've traveled and played a lot of golf over the years. Your favorite golf course you've ever played?
Well, question one, you kind of faded out. What was that?
Question one was just your favorite bottle of whiskey, scotch, bourbon, whatever it is. I want your favorite bottle that you've had, and then two is your favorite course.
Wow. Okay, my favorite bottle, that's hard. I would say one that I sat down and just massively enjoyed that I own. Mitcher's Toasted Rye.
Mitcher's Toasted Rye.
Hard to find. I actually found it in Ireland because you can't find it in the States because it gets gobbled up so fast. So I actually found it in Ireland and brought it back home. Really phenomenal.
That just looks like an Irish bottle. That's a cool like logo. You know what I mean? Like it's got the green with like the old school text around it. It looks like something Conor McGregor would walk around with in his hand.
Yeah, no, Mitcher's is awesome. So that would probably be my favorite. I've had so many good whiskeys, but that one that I own is really good. Favorite golf course? I've played Caves Valley. I've played Ross Point in Ireland. Man, that's a hard one. I really enjoy Caves Valley. It's private. It's out of Baltimore. They have a tour event that comes through every once in a while. We played an NCAA championship there, and one of the owners of Caves was a UVA grad, so I was able to go out there a couple times and tee it up, and it's a spectacular golf course.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't played any golf in Baltimore. I haven't played golf out there. I haven't played much out east, honestly. Last year was like my first time going out to the New York and New Jersey area. Man, they got good golf out east.
I'm going to tell you right now, you go up in that northeast corridor, there is some spectacular golf. That crazy, like man. Philly all the way up through Connecticut, man, there is some beautiful golf. You come through the mid-Atlantic, it's spectacular. And then you go to cookie cutter Florida, they all kind of look the same, which is fine. But, you know, it serves its purpose. But, yeah, I would say Caves Valley was really good. Ross Point in Ireland is on the western side.
Yeah, I've got a couple of these. I've got a couple of Irish flags behind me. What do I got? I got Enniscrone, County Sligo.
Sligo's good.
Nard and Portneau. We did it. That was my trip from 2 years ago. And I just, I loved it. It was just awesome.
If you haven't been to Ireland to play golf, you got to do it at least once. I'm actually
it'll change your life, man. Like it really will. Like it's hard to explain.
Yeah, I'm going there twice in 2026. I have a friend of mine over there that's getting married, and then my son graduated from high school, and his gift is a trip anywhere. He's a golfer, so he goes, we're going to Ireland for 8 days, Dad, and we've already mapped out. We're going to head south to Cork, come up through the western part, through Sligo, play Carn, go through Donegal, and then swing back into Dublin as we leave. So we've already mapped it out.
St. Patrick's Links at Rosapenna, is that on the list?
It is not, but we can look at it.
If it is, I would tell you, try and get that on your list. I don't, you know, I'm so bad with geography, and like I can't remember where like County Sligo was in relation to where St. Patrick's Links was.
Yeah.
But if it is like if it is remotely close, you know, like on your route there, I'm telling you, make it a priority. It is so good.
My running joke with all my Irish buddies, I'm like, there's nothing on your island that's that far away. Like,
yeah, that's true.
I drove from Virginia, so we're in central Virginia, and we drove all the way out to kind of the tip of southwest Virginia. It took like 4.5 hours like to get to the tip, and they're like, yeah, you could almost lap the entire country. So it's nothing in Ireland's too far away, other than the cars are kind of funny, and they're on the wrong side of the road. And then you start getting in the back roads, it gets a little goofy. But no, I would say Ireland by far is an absolute must do as a golfer. You got to do it at least once.
I'm looking. So Sligo is more on the
northwest.
It's northwest. St. Patrick's Links is like Northern Ireland, like all the way north.
Okay.
All the way.
So Northern Ireland, technically not Ireland.
Yeah, technically, yeah, it's Northern Ireland, but it's about 2 hours away. It's 2 hours just straight north from Sligo. So a
funny story, when we were talking about doing this, about 2 years ago, I flew over to Ireland. A buddy of mine that's a golf coach there, Gareth McShay, picked me up. The guy that's getting married, he's a solicitor, but a avid golfer, you know, plays all the amateur stuff in Ireland. Picked me up at the airport. I land at like 5:30 in the morning, jump in the car, and we immediately drive north to Northern Ireland, which is not Ireland. And trust me, the Irish guys let me know about it the whole time, because we went to Bushmills and we went to Royal Portrush. We didn't play, but we walked around and just kind of saw the course. And then we did 7 whiskey distilleries and played 4 golf courses and said, all right, this is doable. This is something that we can produce in the future. So for my membership out there, I actually walked the walk, and I went ahead and toured it and did it and made sure that this was feasible. And that's the kind of stuff that I do for my members.
Yeah, that's awesome. You do some cool retreat stuff, and you just
experiences that's right.
It's just that people can't like normally find. I think retreats and those types of things are going to become a lot more popular in the coming years, because people want, at the end of the day, they want experiences, man. Like they want it, to your point, like being a community with people that like love the same and have the same, you know, passions as they do. And, you know, those things can be, they can be hard to find. So I hope that at least you find a few people that listen to this podcast to see how passionate about it you are and how much of an expert you are in the field. It was just an awesome conversation. Really appreciate you reaching out and coming on, Brian.
All right, Jordan, thanks for having me. And again, visit us at golfcast.com, Whiskey Golf Cigars. We have a ranking system in there. So I built the tomato movie thing. So I basically have a group of experts for golf courses and whiskeys and cigars. And then you as a fan, you can compare your ranking, Rotten Tomatoes, right? I created the
Rotten Tomatoes. I got you.
For golf courses, whiskeys, pubs, cigar lounges. So go in there, give us your thoughts on different cigar lounges and anything. Like I said, create a community, start doing stuff with us. And like I said, I think everybody's getting more insular and getting more stuck at home in this little scroll world. We want to blow that up. We want to meet you. We want to go places, hang out, play golf, enjoy the finer things in life. So if that interests you, find us at golfcast.com.
I love it, Brian. We'll talk to you soon.
I appreciate it, George.
Great combo.
All right. Thank you.